Welcome, 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 one and all. It is time to get it on again. It is the David Sparks Show. And I hope you all have been snug as a bug under a rug, getting ready to get into a tug with another June bug. I've been well, keeping my fingers crossed. It's been a rough week for the family. We've had sickness in the family. If you could put some thoughts out, some of that cosmic energy that you emanate so well would be greatly appreciated. But I got a story to tell you today. And why am I telling this story? Well, because I think this story tells a lot of life lessons. Taught me a big life lesson. Never to chew off more than you could spit out. Or you're going to get spit out, boy. Just the way it is sometimes. The age-old essential lesson of do not bite off more than you can chew. And in this story, I got chewed up trying to bite off more than I could chew. Prologue. Corbin, Kentucky, 1974. And the name of this story is How Healthy Doses of Running the Streets, Cussing, Fighting, and Lighting Fire to Things Make for a Good Childhood Curriculum. Hey, Ruth Decker! Suck on my pecker! I exclaimed with a half-raised lip smile brimming across my face while my hands grabbed my crotch in a show of obnoxious bravado. It was getting near supper time and time to return home from another afternoon of playing in the adventure zone that was Corbin, Kentucky in 1974. I was barely 6 years old and in the first grade at Central Elementary School in Corbin, Kentucky, a small southeastern Kentucky town 20 miles away from the Kentucky-Tennessee border. My parents had moved to Corbin from Dayton, Ohio to attend college at Cumberland College in Williamsburg, Kentucky, where my father and mother studied religion and nursing respectively in preparation for careers spent tending to spiritual and medicinal needs in southeastern Kentucky and later southern Ohio. The stereotype of preacher's kids is that of the children who were the wildest and most out of control outside of the Sunday house of the steeple. And well, let's just say us Sparks boys did our best to live up to the time-honored tradition and fraternity of preacher's kids worldwide running the streets, cussing, fighting, lighting fire to things, shooting birds, cans and bottles with BB guns, experimenting with small fireworks, disrupting church services, and a whole slew of other misbegotten adventures now sternly engraved in my family's PK, that means preacher's kid, lore. Ruth Decker and my lovely slogan that I invented for her would play a large part in this lore, as we shall find out later. But first, a few words about Corbin. 1974 Corbin, Kentucky, snuggled off of Interstate I-75 in the picturesque Appalachian Mountains of southeastern Kentucky, was about as great of a place as any to begin plying our special brand of mischief-making. Corbin was a sleepy little town where not much went down except for Friday night football games in the fall and sports in the winter and summer, but downtime from those activities provided us more than enough opportunity for adventure and trouble, which always seemed to go hand in hand. Well, I'm quite positive that there were child molesters, abductors, and murderers in 1974, as there have been and will be throughout history. You surely couldn't tell it in Corbin back then. The mass media paranoia surrounding child abductions and the horrifying specter of becoming a milk carton statistic just didn't exist then as it does in our modern society where America's Most Wanted is on 24/7 in reruns. With a serious crime that occurred maybe once every decade, Corbin was safe for kids to roam, and parents encouraged kids to get out of the house and play. And play we did. Small armies of grade school kids ruled the streets of 1970s Corbin, roaming freely on foot or more popularly, banana seat bicycles. It was with this grand technological achievement of the banana seat bicycle that I would gain induction into the group of kids who did nothing but ride their bikes around town, playing in creek beds, ball fields, the bulk garbage dump adjoining the schoolyard, or any other number of Corbin sites. Yes, we had an actual landfill not too far away from the school playground, with the hulking carcasses of old wrecked cars strewn amongst large rocks, old lazy boy recliners, and all kinds of dangerous stuff for kids to hurt themselves and have grand fun playing on. Having been taught a whole new vocabulary of cuss words and dirty phrases from the older kids my brother Scott hung out with, I was an eager inductee into the Bicycle Creek Bed Foragers and the Evil Knievel Copycat Society that my brothers and I had fallen into so naturally since moving to Corbin just before I entered kindergarten the year before. The unofficial Bicycle Creek Bed Foragers and Knievel Society pretty much was what it said it was, a group of kids who practiced the art of ramp building and bicycle daredevilry while also killing time foraging creek beds for crawdaddies, snakes, turtles, and other scary and fascinating forms of Mother Nature. When we weren't doing that, we were pretending to be Evil Knievel on our banana-seated Huffies received the prior Christmas. Knievel was the coolest man on the planet to kids in 1974, and a boon to television and orthopedic surgeons alike, building ramps on the Central Elementary School yard in order to see who could be the most Knievel-esque among us was a daily ritual in the summertime and during the school year when all the school staff had left in the afternoon. And if by chance we were unable to ramp jump or creek crawl, we'd go begging at construction sites for spare wood, which we would build makeshift forts and clubhouses with that were completely structurally unsound, but somehow managed to hold us. We did build one that was 2 stories tall, which in reality was closer to 6 feet tall and fairly wobbly, but it held 6 of us 6 to 8 year old boys, shaking yet reliably. The first floor was for the younger members of the society, while the upper and really shaky floor of the second story contained room for older members who had established themselves as clubhouse elders by this time. How convenient for them to establish rules like this, I thought, since it meant that their rule of the society would extend indefinitely. However, at the tender age of 6, I really wasn't in tune with such psychological remedies like Sun Tzu's Art of War to rid myself of dictatorships, so I'd have to sit back, bide my time, and plan for the ultimate takeover of tyrants one day down the line. Until that time, though, I'd have to accept being on the bottom rung of the society, dishing out nightly verbal abuse to Ruth Decker as my lone hierarchical power play. There were much bigger battles to be fought, though. Championships in brick jumping were conducted almost every time the society gathered. Although it was somewhat dangerous for little kids to be running their bicycles down hills at an extreme rate of speed before launching themselves forward into the air off of a makeshift ramp constructed off some concrete blocks with a piece of plywood found near the dump, the only real injuries that occurred were minor scrapes. But ramps with dependable asphalt landing strips were pretty staid for us Evil Knievel emulators. It was around that same time when Knievel took his act from a motorcycle ramp to a rocket over the Snake River Canyon in Idaho that our society followed suit by attempting our first creek bed jump. Naturally, geography was a bigger challenge than sticks or stones and bricks laid down to measure who jumped the longest. While the previous jumps on land were a challenge, they weren't formidable ones like the geography of a creek bed in a body of water presented. I would have had to make the jump approximately 8 feet in the air to land safely on the other side. Like Knievel's jump, my jump would also be treading uncharted ground for an unofficial society member such as myself. Unlike Knievel, whose jump was unable to find success in leaping Snake River Canyon, but escaped injury by parachuting out his rocket ship, I wasn't as lucky. I dislocated and fractured my elbow while trying the first leap over the creek bed. Fantastic. It was a nasty one, too. My dislocated elbow was a jumbled stick of disjointed plumbing complemented by agonizing pain to go with the fracture-dislocation combo. But I lived and went on to tell the tale. The same thing happened when I jumped out of a tree and accidentally landed on a bike wheel, slicing my foot and requiring 4 stitches. Or there was the time when I ran down a tree with a nail sticking out of it while riding one of the bikes uncontrollably downhill. Or the episode with the snake bite on my kneecap down by the creek bed that had my mother, the nursing student, freaking out to get me to a doctor, only to find out that it was the bite of a common garter snake. not the feared and poisonous water moccasin or copperhead, which are so prevalent in that part of Kentucky. These and a litany of other activities we society members participated in were unsuitable for modern children of the cul-de-sac, kids ostensibly born into this world covered in bubble wrap. Unlike most shielded six-year-old kids of modern times, I was knee-deep in a gang that believed wholeheartedly in what philosophers refer to as raw qualia, or feeling. Qualia is a term used in philosophy of mind to describe the subjective quality of conscious experience. Qualia is a term that describes what it feels like to each individual taking part in something. Examples of qualia are pain, the taste of food, or the feeling that one gets while sailing through the air on a Huffy with a banana seat. While we weren't aware of the concept of qualia at the time, in actuality, we were swimming in it. Back then, there were no such thing as video games or DVDs, and only three channels on the television. Maybe four if you lived in a big city with a UFS station. In order for parents to go keep their children from driving them completely batshit crazy, kids were encouraged to go outside and play. We weren't allowed to watch television until long after the sun had gone down, when we weren't allowed to take part in life anymore in the world outside of our three-bedroom Kentucky home nestled just up the hill from the schoolyard next to the bulk garbage dump that doubled as one of our playgrounds. Everywhere one sees children nowadays, it's usually in a car seat, in front of a television set, or if they're really adventurous, on a bicycle, wherein they are permitted to traverse the entire 200-yard length of the cul-de-sac, mind you, covered in enough armor to shame an American soldier in Iraq, to warm up for the high life of the day, playing Rockstar on the Wii system in the living room before supper of processed agro-industrial complex chicken nuggets and Mountain Dew. When my mind fast-forwards to 2014 and the jungle gyms of old being torn down to accommodate newer and safer jungle gyms with soft landings for Jolene and Johnny, I wonder if in the totality of their existence that we're really making them safer. Sure, a Stay Puft Marshmallow-esque existence is certainly bound to prevent more injuries to a child, but then again, so can a padded room with a straitjacket. And when I think back to 1974, what seems like unadulterated freedom to be a kid would probably land my parents in jail for child neglect, were they bringing me up in the soft and dryer sheet tumble new millennium we find ourselves in. But would they really be neglecting me by letting me run around all day with a bunch of kids on bikes? I can see and hear the television reporters interviewing my mom right now. Mrs. Sparks, can we ask you a few questions about your children? Sure. Is it true you let your children play in the yard and even ride their bikes to the creek bed and to the carryout store a mile down the road with absolutely no supervision? Why, yes. Is that a problem? At last report, Miss Sparks was being held in the Montgomery County Jail while charges of child endangerment are completed to the prosecutor's office. We'll continue to follow this breaking story and keep you informed. But in reality, neither my parents nor the other parents in the lower middle class Kentucky small town were endangering their children whatsoever. We kids were doing a fabulous job of that all on our own. On our creek bed raids alone, a veritable cornucopia of varied injuries from cuts, bruises, bug bites, bacterial infection, and possible gastrointestinal disaster after my older brother Scott discovered that swallowing the minnows we caught in the creek alive really freaked the other kids out. In addition to the aforementioned injuries and biological challenges, there were the pecking order challenges that young boys especially take part in with grandiose fervor. Older brothers who had the edge in size were able to attain silverback gorilla status in the unofficial society. Being nearly at the bottom of the society hierarchy had lots of downsides. You always got to go last in any game, whether it was kickball, baseball, or whatever was going down. But there was hope. There was Ruth Decker, the gangly older sister, third grade sister of Jeff Decker, one of the unofficial society members who lived next door to us. Ruth was pretty mouthy towards all us boys, and the oldest members, who had taught me all of my newfound cursing skills that would eventually earn me a turn at the altar of soap and mouth from my mother, encouraged me like gangbusters to take on the disaffected Ruth with my new slogan of, "Hey Ruth Decker! Suck out my pecker!" which I was able to utter without any harm to myself whatsoever for quite a while. Not only was I proud of my newfound cursing abilities, but I found that cursing could be even more fun when combined with rhyming and sloganeering. The newfound power I found in my catchy new phrase directed towards Ruth had me looking towards life at the near bottom of the kid food chain as not so bad. I wasn't at the total bottom. Unfortunately, Ruth didn't agree. I can't remember how many times I had uttered my catchy new phrase that could have just as easily been uttered by Cartman from South Park. Perhaps it was the 10th time or maybe the 15th time. It really doesn't matter because whatever time it was, Ruth Decker had had her fill. I was 3 words into my evening declaration of what Ruth could do with my pecker, but something was different. Ruth, the skinny girl with stringy blonde hair, was turning red. Beet red. Her nostrils began flaring like a Kentucky Derby thoroughbred who had just been insulted with offers to breed from donkey farms. And then, like an NFL linebacker in full stride, she lunged at me. Before I knew it, I was tackled, and she was on top of me with both legs, pinning my chest to the ground. I was captive and helpless to her advance. "Don't you ever tell me to suck your pecker again!" Ruth screeched like a banshee filled to the rim with righteous indignation, the result of one too many invitations to suck what rhymed with Decker. And then the stuffin' began. Ruth began stuffing my mouth with the pea gravel that surrounded the swing sets from which I would make my nightly pronouncement of what Ruth could do with my undeveloped manhood. When she was done stuffing my mouth with that precious pea gravel, she took another handful and sprayed my face with a good handful. It was like a briar hopper buckshot coming out of the hands of Ruth. She had a couple more choice words for me before pouring another handful of gravel on my face and taking off to her house for evening supper. One for which I am sure was a satisfying one for her. So what exactly does this mouthful of gravel I survived mean in the context of kids running the streets then, and, very seldom, today? While most parents would surely cringe at the thought of their child being exposed to bumps, bruises, stitches, snake bites, and filthy language, it was the greatest thing that happened to me growing up. I learned to negotiate and navigate on my own playground society in ways that help me to this day. I am not afraid to jump into new situations, and I also learned how to never lose a fight again. Don't pick one you can't win. For on that fateful southeastern Kentucky afternoon, a mouthful of pea gravel taught me a magnanimous life lesson that I use to this very day. Choose your battles well, or you might just end up with a mouthful of pea gravel and a heart full of humble pie.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, and you're listening to In Your Face Radio.
Would you like to record now? Start anywhere you like.
This is In Your Face Radio. Political talk without all the bullshit.
All right, we are back on the David Sparks Show, and I hope you enjoyed that tale of eating some humble pie made of pea gravel. I think it's a lesson that a lot of us can learn in America because we pick a lot of fights that we can't win. And that day with Ruth, I couldn't win that fight. But I picked it anyway because I wanted it to be looked upon as grand and taking my stand on the stepladder of domination over someone else. At least I wasn't on the bottom. But Ruth proved to me that, yeah, you were. And seems to me that a lot of the fights, issues, concerns, so on, so forth, that we have going on here in America are pretty much due to fights that we pick that we can't win. We pick a lot of fights in the Middle East because, well, we can't subdue and dominate the entire Middle East, so we've got to try to work it to our advantage somehow, and usually ends up a giant fucking clusterfuck. The war on drugs. Shouldn't really have picked that fight, should we? Didn't really work out too well. the main factor in helping destroy our cities all across the United States. That was a great idea. And it, too, a fight we couldn't win, but we got into because of our bravado and possible just maybe national brain damage. They were fighting in Utah to keep the gays from having the right to be married, which ultimately will be proven to be a total losing battle, waste of time. Much like so many battles that we try to fight. Folks, you gotta pick your battles. You know, we have so many great groups in this country, literally thousands of them, working to do good things on all kinds of different issues. But this kind of scattershot approach to fixing politics in the United States through issues, I don't see it being a battle worth fighting. There's really only one battle worth fighting nowadays, and that is the move to amend the Constitution to abolish corporate personhood and to get money out of politics. We can hem and we can haul, we can talk all day long about what needs to be done, what needs to be fixed, what needs to be voted on, but we really look at the core issue that is driving the massive corruption in America and throughout the world. It's the issue of corporations being allowed to be people and to use money as speech, destroying democracy, destroying everything the Founding Fathers had envisioned the government would be, and turning us into a dystopian state of surveillance, Big Macs, Mountain Dew, and all the gluttonous, putrid, intestinal rot that goes with it. And that is why I have decided myself to get involved in a group that hits to the core of what is wrong in America today, and that is corporate money, corporate politics, and the vast sea of whoreholes ready to get their mitts on your tax-paying dollars in order to mold the country into their vision of shopping malls, Walmart, NASCAR, Oprah Winfrey, Ellen, with a free Sunday from Applebee's to top all the disgusting mess off. But you can't get politics and money separated. There's no way that's ever going to happen, Dave. That goes right against your theory of picking fights that you can win. Well, sometimes you should pick fights that you can't win. I know that I know that flies in the face of my Ruth Decker story, but sometimes you got to pick a fight that's worth fighting, even if you don't think you can win. Because that fight is worth fighting. My fight with Ruth, well, it wasn't worth winning. And if you happen to live in an area of the country that is unaffected by the mass deindustrialization that's gone on in the United States over the last 30, 40, 50 years, and all those kind of changes, count yourself lucky. Because our downfall, our stupidity, our idiotic acts, almost all of them can be traced back to corporate money affecting politics. If we don't get it out, we're never going to change this republic into a truly free republic. The economy will continue to be rigged for those with money, and situations will continue to get more dismal. The police state will grow, the corporate state will grow, and happiness and the pursuit of it in the United States will wither on the vine. We will become a Dollar Tree Republic, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't believe me. Well, there's one here already. I live in the Dollar Tree Republic of the United States, seemingly, Dayton, Ohio. It's almost like when you go and do a drive around the city around here, it's like, hath God forsaken us? Because that's what it looks like. It looks like a deindustrialized hellhole. And it's not just Detroit. It's Dayton. It's Cincinnati. It's Cleveland. It's hit Indianapolis. It's all over the country. And it's coming to your place next if it hasn't hit. If we don't get this money out, we will become a Dollar Tree Republic. And that is why I wrote this song. It's called Standing in the Shadows of the Dollar Tree Store. You will be next if we do not move to get this corruption out of politics. Go to movetoamend.org. Check them out. Sign the signatures. Get involved, folks. Have a great, great week. This is David Sparks from the David Sparks Show. I thank you for listening. I'm out of here. Have a great week.
Bags float by.
Standing in the shadows of the valley of the Dollar Tree Store.
Everything that used to be found for a decent price here and around can now be found at the Dollar Tree Store. All those little places all throughout North Carolina and places like that that made neato products and food. Stuff like that, jams and jellies, so on and whatnot. And now at the Dollar Tree, but guess what?
They ain't made here no more. They ship them goods here from China right through the back door.
A lot of them goods come packed with a substance that has seemingly turned the population, at least in my neighborhood, I don't know about yours, into what seems like a universe of whale-like, barbiturate-addicted human beings high on the after effects of high fructose corn syrup, which comes in almost everything, even the fruit juice. You gotta look real hard. Every once in a while you can find some fruit juice at the Dollar Tree. Don't got no high fructose corn syrup in it, but you gotta look real long and real hard and
read the label, read the label, read the label, read the label.
'Cause you know what's big in our economy? Dollar Tree Store feeds right into it.
Tumors are big business for our economy. Tumors are big business for our economy. Tumors are big business for our economy in the Dollar Tree Store.
In my neighborhood, let me tell you about it. Right around the corner from the Dollar Tree store in my neighborhood, there's a pimp named Shorty. He thinks nobody knows he's a pimp, but everybody knows he's a pimp because he ain't real smart. Anyway, most pimps ain't real smart, but that's another subject for another time. But Shorty, he's got one leg. And all his hookers look like the Hair Bears from Hanna-Barbera. They go out on the street about 9 a.m. in the morning looking like they just got gangbanged by a truckload of Mexicans. And they probably did. And meanwhile, while Shorty's pimping his hoes outside on the street, he's inside running a sock-stealing ring at the Dollar Tree store. I swear to God, I do not make these things up. I only observe them.
I'm standing in the shadows of the valley of the Dollar Tree Store.
Man, if you got a baby and you're feeding it an all Dollar Tree Store diet, you better get some diapers to take care of that. That's gonna be funky.
AM. FM. In Your Face Radio.